The final investigator I met with was Dr. David Steensma, and to begin, he discussed Abstract 102, evaluating venetoclax plus low-dose cytarabine in older patients with acute myeloid leukemia.
This is a study in which venetoclax was added to low-dose cytarabine for patients who are not great candidates for intensive chemotherapy. And all these combinations with venetoclax have a similar theme, and that is that if we could inhibit BCL2 with venetoclax, that may push cells that wouldn't be killed by chemotherapy alone sort of over the edge to die, and that we might see some really remarkable response rates in diseases that traditionally are quite refractory to conventional cytotoxic. And that's really exactly what was seen in this trial. It was with low-dose cytarabine, a combination with venetoclax. The venetoclax was given at the 600 milligram a day dose level. We don't see the type of tumor lysis that you see in some of the lymphoid disorders, in myeloid disorders, so the escalation can be a lot quicker. In this study, the escalation was a 5-day ramp-up rather than the multi-week ramp-up that we see being used by our colleagues who treat lymphoid disorders. And the overall CR, CRI, PR rate was 75% among the 20 patients that were evaluable with this particular combination. So, you know, that's a much higher response rate than we would see with cytarabine alone, suggesting there's real synergy.
So just a flash on, you're talking about CLL and lymphoma, but also myeloma, amazingly enough. We've been hearing about this. Anyhow, in terms of this, you know, venetoclax obviously is available.
Right.
Are these data encouraging enough that, are there any situations where you have attempted to use it outside a trial setting or would do so?
I have done outside the trial setting, as have my colleagues. The big barrier is insurance, of course. You know, it's not an on-label indication. Insurance companies want to see data before they'll reimburse it. That being said, if I have somebody with, say, a complex karyotype, a P53 mutation, maybe somebody with therapy-related, either high-risk MDS or AML, I know that I'm going to have a reasonable response with a hypomethylating agent. Particularly, we saw the recent New England Journal paper with 10-day decitabine, but those are not durable. And the hope is that with venetoclax, not only can we increase the CR rate, but maybe it'll be more durable. There's randomized trials going on, but in the meantime, in special patients like that, we are adding this off-label.
Any speculations about why you don't see TLS here?
I think these cells are probably less sensitive than the lymphoid cells are to it. I think that, you know, they are extremely dependent on BCL2 for survival, malignant lymphocytes. And I think in myeloid disorders, although BCL2 also plays a role, it's just not as critical a survival signal. You don't see the very rapid, robust tumor lysis. That being said, you can still probably get an augmented response. But there's randomized trials going on with all these different combinations to try to prove that.
So any comments on Abstract 449? I guess more data looking at midostaurin in terms of age of the patients, dose of response, and FLT3 positive patients. This is a follow-up to the big study that your colleague presented last year.
That's right. So the big study that Rich Stone presented last year was an international trial in which patients with FLT3 activating mutations who were candidates for intensive chemotherapy, so they were age 18 to 60, were treated either with standard induction alone or standard induction plus midostaurin. And there was a survival advantage to the midostaurin. There was a modest increase in complete response rate, and more patients who got the midostaurin were able to go on to transplant. Midostaurin is not currently FDA approved, but it is something that often we can get by compassionate use. And so for patients with FLT3 mutated disease who are not trial candidates, we're either giving them sorafenib, again, an off-label use, but it's out there, or midostaurin, if we can get it, to try to get them to respond in settings where there's few other options. One of the problems with midostaurin, though, is that there's a drug-drug interaction with posaconazole, and posa is increasingly used for patients with fungal disorders. And so this study looked at what dose was required in patients who were on strong CYP3A4 inhibitors, most commonly posaconazole. And they also looked at just what the pharmacokinetics were with the drug. And, you know, so this was not a large randomized study the way that the plenary session presentation last year by Rich Stone was, but it did again show that adding midostaurin to intensive chemotherapy was feasible, and there was not an impact of response on changing the dose if you needed to, if the patient was on POSA or another drug, and there was not a big difference based on the age of the patient. So that was really the key findings of this study.
Could you kind of capsulize your own recommendations to an oncologist in practice who's going to treat a patient with AML and maybe an older patient in terms of specifically what kinds of assays in terms of FLT3 should be done and what actions you think should be taken at this point based on the results?
Right. Well, I think that's an excellent question and a challenging one. Until recently, the NCCN guidelines have really recommended doing two molecular assays, FLT3 and NPM1. And NPM1 is mostly seen in younger patients under age 60. I think there's a lot of question about what other mutations are critical to assess, because, you know, many centers now, academic centers where large volumes of leukemia patients are treated, have their own panels that have 30 genes, 50 genes, 90 genes. And, you know, a lot of that, there may be many mutations that are not actionable. But there are some that I think do change what we do with the patient. Certainly FLT3 is one of those. Certainly IDH1 and IDH2, there are effective targeted agents that are in late phase trials. And so I think it behooves us for our patients with AML to assay for those mutations, if not up front, then at the time of relapse. I think P53 is important to know about, because if we see it, it affects the likelihood of success of transplant. And that may play into a patient's decision if they are a reduced intensity transplant candidate, whether or not to do transplant. And also, you know, the data with the 10-day decitabine are fairly compelling. Again, the responses are not that durable, but high response rate. And so, you know, that might preferentially be something that you would do with the P53 mutant patients. So I think increasingly we're seeing decisions that in the past in AML were based on, is this patient an intensive therapy candidate or not? Is this patient a transplant candidate or not? Those are still key things, but now it's, is there a targeted agent available for their condition, or do they have P53, which puts them in an extremely high risk group so that we should be thinking about other things?
Just a follow-up, we were talking about FLT3 and midostaurin, but there are other FLT3 inhibitors that are being developed, and one, there was an abstract presented at ASH of the Chrysalis trial,
yes,
looking at gilteritinib.
Right.
What is gilteritinib? What are some of the other FLT3 inhibitors? What was presented here? And are any of these agents maybe present an advantage compared to, for example, midostaurin or sorafenib?
So one of the key questions in FLT3 inhibition is how narrow do you want your kinase inhibitory activity to be versus having a kinase inhibitor like midostaurin that's messy. Midostaurin, sorafenib, they, in addition to inhibiting FLT3, they also inhibit VEGF. There is inhibitory activity against protein kinase C. There's some against KIT with midostaurin. In fact, midostaurin is quite useful in mast cell disorders, and it's very possible that it will get FDA approval in mast cell disease before it ever does in FLT3 AML. We saw Jason Gottlieb presented some very nice data in mast cell disease that was published a few months ago in the New England Journal with midostaurin in patients who had bad symptoms, C symptoms from mast cell disease. So kinase inhibitors can be messy like that, or they can be like this agent, gilteritinib, or like quizartinib, or like crenolinib, all of which are moving forward in various trials, a much narrower but more potent FLT3 inhibitory activity. So this was a study of gilteritinib, and these studies have all sort of had butterfly-related names. So this one is chrysalis, and there's a couple others that I can't remember exactly, monarch and some other trial names. And they enrolled 252 patients with relapsed refractory disease, and many of them had had at least two AML therapies previously, and they could have either a FLT3 ITD mutation, which most of them had, or a point mutation at the 835 codon, D835. That's the second most frequent FLT3 activating change. And this started out with a dose escalation and then was a very large dose expansion cohort. And the overall complete response rate was 11%. And then there were 30% additional patients who the blast cleared, but the counts didn't recover. That may still be useful because that may then allow the patient to be bridged to another therapy, potentially even to a transplant, or for post-transplant relapses to a donor lymphocyte infusion or a second transplant. The drug was quite well tolerated. It does have, in some patients, a differentiation syndrome. I'm treating one patient right now who's had a very peculiar response with a differentiating syndrome, but he is clearing his blasts. And so, you know, going forward, the dose that's being tested in phase 3 is 120 milligrams daily. And, you know, we'll see. We'll see where this agent shakes out with respect to other FLT3 inhibitors.
Well, how do you think it's going to shake out?
I think that it's likely that some patients will respond better to one FLT3 inhibitor than another. And so we may even end up using these agents sequentially. So for instance, some of the clinical trials have allowed patients who were previously treated with sorafenib to go in and be treated with gilteritinib or quizartinib. And many of those patients have responded to the second FLT3 inhibitor. So I think that we may end up using these sequentially. But the real utility of FLT3 inhibition is probably going to be up front, the way the midostaurin study was done. You give intensive chemotherapy plus FLT3 inhibitor, or you give a hypomethylating agent plus FLT3 inhibitor for an older patient or someone who's not likely to tolerate 3 and 7.
You think at some point we'll see randomized studies, one FLT3 inhibitor versus another?
I think that's likely.
Interesting. So I want to ask you about a couple abstracts, 590 and 591, looking at an agent. I haven't seen the name of this before, vadostuximab talarine. What is it?
And if you pronounce it with a Spanish accent, it's badastuximab.
Does it have a nickname yet?
So this is the, the short version without the tuximab.
Maybe VADA.
So this is the SGN-33 combination. It's an antibody-drug conjugate. You can think of it very similarly to gemtuzumab ozogamicin, which we had approved for 10 years for MDS. But importantly, both the linker molecule and the cytotoxin are different. And so the toxicity patterns seem to be a little bit different. For instance, there doesn't seem to be as much hepatic veno-occlusive disease or sinusoidal obstruction syndrome with this agent as we see with calicheamycin-containing antibodies. And so that's what this agent is. So this study was reporting an expansion cohort of this drug as monotherapy for patients with AML. And, you know, this drug is being used also in a number of different combinations, both with intensive chemotherapy and with hypomethylating agents. And those trials are ongoing. And so the hope is that by adding this agent to azacitidine or decitabine or intensive chemotherapy will improve responses.
Can you talk a little bit about what the monotherapy response rate is and also what kinds of toxicity or tolerability issues there are?
Yeah, so the response rate is in the 50% range as monotherapy. And this is true even in patients with higher risk disease, higher risk cytogenetics. The types of adverse events that one sees are primarily myelosuppression, neutropenia, thrombocytopenia, But we also do see some of the other types of adverse events like decreased appetite, GI upset that seem to be quite common with any, you know, anti-AML therapy. The hepatotoxicity has been reported, but it seems to be quite uncommon. One of the things that we didn't entirely understand about gemtuzumab ozogamicin was when we saw this veno-occlusive disease, how much was from the cytotoxin, the calicheamicin, how much was from the anti-CD33 therapy, and how much was just because of inflammation from leukemia cells that were in the liver, in the sinusoids next to the Kupffer cells where this antibody could bind and causing a local inflammatory reaction. And I think that's still unresolved, but it does seem that it's probably mostly the cytotoxin, the calicheamicin, that was the cause, because it is seen with CD33A antibody, but just not very commonly.
What about abstract 591 looking at this agent with hypomethylating agents?
Yeah, so this strategy, I think, also makes a lot of sense, looking at it with hypomethylating agents together. And as I mentioned, there are randomized trials now going forward with this combination. This was a report of a phase one study, because in combination, the worry was that it might not be as well tolerated as it was as a monotherapy. And so they gave a lower dose, 10 micrograms per kilogram versus 40 as monotherapy, and then added that to a standard azacitidine or decitabine every 4 weeks backbone. And the response rate, I have to say, was quite impressive for this particularly high-risk group. The complete response rate was 43% for a full CR, 31% for incomplete CR, and then there were a few patients who had stable disease as well. The adverse events were similar to what was seen with the monotherapy, cytopenias and GI upset.
In terms of this agent, first of all, have you had any patients who received it as monotherapy who had, you know, clinical benefit?
We have, yes. We've been participating in these trials in our practice. It's definitely an active drug.
And, you know, where do you see it heading? Do you see it coming into practice?
I think a lot of how we see this drug used depends on two things. One is the results of the randomized trials that are ongoing. You know, is there benefit from it in combination? Otherwise, it's likely to be used as sort of a salvage therapy after the patient's been failed by an HMA. The other sort of wild card here is what's going to happen with gemtuzumab ozogamicin. Is it going to be reapproved by the FDA? Because since it was removed from the market in 2010, there was a positive survival study in AML, adding it to chemotherapy. And it's also a very active drug, as we're going to talk about, in promyelocytic leukemia, which often expresses CD33 quite brightly. So I think that there is the possibility that gemtuzumab ozogamicin will be reapproved. Hard to say what the indication will be, but that may influence usage patterns with both this drug, the vadastuximab, and gemtuzumab.
What is the most likely population that the vadastuximab would be used in?
I think we'd probably see it in combination with hypomethylating agents in a patient population who's not a great candidate for intensive chemotherapy. I think that's likely to be first shot across the bow. I think that also the APL data are very intriguing, and although we have quite a high response rate with the current arsenic and atropine therapy, we can always do better, especially for high-risk patients. So that is another group where I think it's potentially going to be quite useful. One of the things that I think we have to think about moving forward is there are a lot of different chemotherapy or hypomethylating agent plus trials. So azacitidine, decitabine plus IDH inhibitors, azacitidine, decitabine plus venetoclax, azacitidine, decitabine plus immune checkpoint inhibitors, azacitidine, decitabine plus this agent, vadastuximab. So, you know, is it going to end up being something where we're using these in sequence? Is it something where we're going to be adding four or five drugs together, potentially to get cures in some of these patients who just, you know, therapy right now is palliative. Only time will tell, but that is definitely the trend right now in AML and higher risk MDS therapy.
So let's move on now and talk about, of course, a topic everybody wants to talk about nowadays, checkpoint inhibitors.
Yes.
And you guys are there too. And you'll see there's a paper here combining it with azacitidine in AML. Can you talk about that?
I will. And I'll first talk about what is some of the rationale and then what are some of the challenges with using checkpoint inhibitors in myeloid disorders. So the rationale, especially for combining it with an agent like azacitidine or decitabine, is that these agents change gene expression. They may change expression of antigens on the surface of the cells. And if then with an immune checkpoint inhibitor, you could trigger a T-cell response against those new antigens, that could be quite a potent approach that could lead to deep and durable remissions. One of the things, though, that we've been disappointed by thus far in myeloid disorders is lack of response as single agents to these drugs. You can give these drugs in metastatic lung cancer or melanoma as single agents and see robust responses. We don't see that in myeloid neoplasms. Guillermo Garcia Manero presented a study of nivolumab and ipilimumab alone and in combination in high-risk MDS and didn't see any responses to the monotherapy. However, it's possible that by adding these agents to either hypomethylating agents or chemotherapy that we might see a synergistic effect. And so this was a 50-patient study from MD Anderson in which they used nivolumab in addition to a hypomethylating agent in patients with AML. And they saw a response rate that I would say was consistent with what you would expect with azacitidine alone. So they had a complete response rate of 18% and a CRI rate of 15% and a hematologic improvement rate of about the same. And so, you know, I think there weren't a lot of additional adverse events. There wasn't a lot of additional toxicity. But I think we really need randomized trials to know, is there a contribution in terms of response or survival to adding these checkpoint inhibitors.
What's the rationale, theoretically, for, I guess, a synergy between a hypomethylating agent and a checkpoint inhibitor?
Yeah, so mostly it's based on the way that hypomethylating agents change antigen expression. For instance, if you use a hypomethylating agent after transplant, some of the antigen expression changes that occur favor a graft versus leukemia effect and may reduce, actually, the graft versus host problem. And so, you know, we know that these agents, because of the way that they alter gene expression by changing methylation, that they can lead to expression of new antigens. There's some data that may lead to an immune response. There's upregulation, for instance, of interferon pathway genes, which gets at the old debate about how exactly do these drugs work in MDS or AML as single agents. Is azacitidine, is it a cytotoxic? Is it like cytarabine? Is it truly working by hypomethylation? Nobody's been able to clearly show that in patients. Or is there a third method of response, which is triggering an endogenous immune response? And if it's the third, then adding nivolumab, adding ipilimumab, adding pembrolizumab, or one of the checkpoint inhibitors would be quite attractive. The one setting where checkpoint inhibitors have shown utility in myeloid disorders is in patients post-transplant who relapse outside of the bone marrow. So let's say we have somebody that relapses in the skin or in the lung, and they don't have bone marrow disease, but they do have disease in these immune sanctuary sites. Those are patients that often do respond to ipilimumab. And one of my colleagues, Matt Davids, he's a CLL doctor, but he did an IPI study that allowed patients with relapsed leukemias of any type post-transplant. And we saw some really nice responses in AML with extramedullary disease to ipilimumab.
Wow, that's fascinating. So I'm curious what your thoughts are about Abstract 905, another, and a bunch of abstracts over the year, particularly by Dr. Garcia Manero on oral azacitidine. Kind of makes me think about, like, what's it take to get an oral agent, you know, made available?
Yeah, so this agent, CC486, is an oral formulation of azacitidine. And why an oral formulation of azacitidine or of decitabine, which is also in development, are attractive? That first of all, it's more convenient for patients. Many of these patients wouldn't have to come to the doctor nearly as frequently if they weren't getting injectable AZA. The second attractive feature of an oral agent in this population is that you can explore other schedules that just wouldn't be feasible with an injectable hypomethylating agent. For instance, you could give low dose of the hypomethylating agent every day or for 21 days out of 28 days per month. And that might give you some of the benefits of hypomethylation, if that is how these class of drugs is working, for much more of the treatment cycle. I think that is something that's very exciting and attractive, to be able to give low dose therapy for a prolonged period in this condition. It's also interesting to think about what the implications are for benign hematology. So for instance, we know that azacitidine and decitabine improve fetal hemoglobin production, increase fetal hemoglobin production. So in sickle cell disease, where you'd like to get that fetal hemoglobin up, or in severe thalassemia, could you give a patient a low-dose azacitidine and it would decrease their sickling crises? That's certainly feasible.
What was presented there?
So this was a multiple center study, and that was the difference from what's been presented with CC486 before. Guillermo Garcia Manero, it's incredible what he's able to do, get so many patients on study at MD Anderson. But this was a multi-center study that Guillermo led. And so they had 40 patients who had previously received a hypomethylating agent. Most of them had MDS. 12 out of the 40 had AML, and then they were given the CC486. And the response rate in the patients who were refractory to prior hypomethylating agents was 38%, and the overall response rate was 35%. And the drug was pretty well tolerated. It induced some of the kinds of things that you would expect with injectable hypomethylating agents, such as cytopenias. And there were a few febrile neutropenia episodes and some gastrointestinal adverse events, but not different from what you would expect with azacitidine injectable. So I think that, you know, this agent has certainly a chance of regulatory approval. Where we would use it, I think we'd have to think about that long and hard. Would it be a replacement for azacitidine? Well, we don't have a survival study with CC486 the way we do with azacitidine with the study that Pierre Fineau published 8 years ago. So we'd have to take that into consideration. But if you had a patient that lived quite a distance from the oncologist center or wanted to avoid trips to the infusion unit, this is a very attractive approach. I will also mention that there is an oral decitabine that's in development. It's called E7727. What it is, it's a combination of decitabine fixed dose with a cytidine deaminase inhibitor, which prevents it from being broken down in the gut and in the liver with first pass metabolism. And we saw an abstract presented at the annual meeting that showed that the pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics were identical to this oral formulation compared with injectable decitabine. So that potentially could be in the mix as well.
Do you think that these agents, you know, should be? I mean, I'm not really asking sort of from an FDA perspective, but I mean, would you like them to be available? Would you utilize either one of these?
I would. If these were available, I would use them on a case-by-case basis. But I definitely, for older patients where our treatment is primarily palliative, I would use them in lieu of the injectable agents. There are going to be insurance considerations with an oral agent. If these are very expensive and a patient has Medicare that covers well the injectable agent, but not the oral agent. That might affect which one we used. And I really would like to see some exploration of longer schedules with both of these agents to see if maybe we could do a better job by reducing methylation for a longer time.
Another target, you know, when you talk about targeted therapy of AML that we're starting to hear some interesting things about is IDH1. And there was a paper presented at ASH Abstract 1070 looking at IDH1 mutational burden in patients who are receiving AG120, a first-in-class inhibitor of mutant IDH1.
So there's a couple of IDH inhibitors that are fairly far advanced. AG120 is an IDH1 inhibitor, and AG221 is an IDH2 inhibitor. There are others that are moving forward, but they're at an earlier stage. Both of these agents have about an 18% complete response rate, which is not that high, but many other patients do have blast reduction or stability of disease for a prolonged period of time. And this particular report was about AG120 in IDH1 mutant acute leukemias, and they looked at what happened to the IDH mutation with therapy over time. And there were a couple patients that were presented. One of them is one of my own patients who had very long and very durable responses where the IDH mutation became no longer detectable or was only detectable at a very low level, at a very low variant allele frequency. Now, one of the things that we're learning as we go along is that when patients do relapse, they may relapse with a subclone of leukemia cells that doesn't have an IDH mutation anymore. So for instance, my patient who had more than 2 years of a nice response to this compound has now relapsed with a clone of cells that don't have an IDH mutation. They have an SF3B1 mutation, a splicing mutation driving them. And so that may be what we see in a subset of patients who are treated with this for a prolonged period. But I think the take-home message from this abstract was that the reduction that we see in blast cells with this agent in many cases is accompanied also by a clonal reduction, by a decrease in the mutant allele burden, and that that may be durable in some patients.
What fraction of patients with AML have this mutation?
So if you look at IDH1 and IDH2, it's about 25 to 30%. IDH2 mutations are more common, so this one is more in the 5 to 10% range.
And again, where do you see agents like this fitting in, or do you see them coming into practice, and if so, how soon?
So there are ongoing trials of these agents in addition to chemotherapy and in addition to hypomethylating agents. Very similar to what we talked about with venetoclax, very similar to what we talked about with immune checkpoint inhibitors, very similar to what we talked about with vadastuximab, the anti-CD33 agent. So I think if you have a patient who has one of these targetable mutations, then this is going to be your drug that you're going to want to add to a chemotherapy backbone. Right now, it's largely people with relapsed refractory disease, but now these are being moved up front.
Now, your patient with the relapsed disease sounds like has benefited from this therapy.
Absolutely. I mean, he and his family are incredibly grateful because it really gave him an extra 2.5 years that almost certainly he wouldn't have had otherwise.
And this was monotherapy?
This was monotherapy.
Any tolerability issues with the drug?
Absolutely none for him. There have been patients who've had problems with edema or with GI upset or headaches or, you know, some of these types of things happen. But my patient was able to be fully functional. He's a big cook. He made a huge Sicilian dinner at Christmas time. It was just really great to see.
You know, in error, we see so many trials for so long now where you add something to an efficacious therapy, you can't really figure out what's going on or it's not that easy. You don't have to hear too many cases like this one to go, hey, you know, why don't I have this available? But I guess we'll see.
Right. Hopefully we will, because there are patients right now who have an IDH mutation who can't get on a trial because there's no trial for them. And the sponsor has been very stingy about compassionate use, as they often are when they're hoping for an approval. So I hope these agents get approved soon.
So let's talk about, I know, one of your favorite topics, MDS.
Yes.
And there was a big paper presented. I was really curious to see what your thoughts were. Lenalidomide with and without EPA and granulocyte stimulating factor.
Sure. There were two papers presented. One, Alan List presented the ECOG E2905 study. That was for patients for whom ESAs alone had failed, and a few patients got on whose baseline EPA level was over 500. And that compared lenalidomide alone to lenalidomide plus continuing the ESA or starting the ESA if it hadn't been before. The ECOG E2905 study is actually a lot easier to interpret than this one. I moderated this session, and I still don't understand this European study because it was so confusing, because you could add EPA back, you could add GCSF, there were different dose levels. It was just a very, very, very challenging study to understand. The bottom line for clinicians, I think, is that lenalidomide plus EPO has a higher hematologic response rate than lenalidomide alone. But where we would use these agents together in combination, I think, is a little bit tricky. So the ECOG E2905 study, they found with the lenalidomide alone, 29% response rate, lenalidomide plus EPO, 40% response rate. So a little bit higher when the combination was given. In this study, they saw a response rate of 33% in patients for whom EPO had failed. And it's so confusing the way all the EPO was added back and the GCSF that I don't even want to get into that. But I do think that this suggests that in some cases, lenalidomide may resensitize to EPO. And so right now the party line is if a patient's had 8 to 12 weeks of an ESA, they haven't responded, you stop the drug and you move on. These studies collectively suggest that if you're going to add lenalidomide at least, then maybe you should continue the EPO if you can get it paid for, because the response rate might be a little bit higher with the combination.
For practical purposes, where does lenalidomide fit into your DEL5Q and non-DEL5Q algorithm nowadays?
For DEL5Q, I think it's pretty straightforward for lower risk disease because the response rate, the transfusion independence, the hemoglobin response rate is so high, over 70%. So it is very acceptable to use it as a first line therapy. If you want to use EPO first and the patient's serum EPO levels under 500, that's fine. But lenalidomide then would be if the EPO didn't work. For the non-DEL5Q patients, it's a little bit more difficult because the response rate is lower, 26%, to monotherapy with len in two different randomized studies. And also, it's an off-label use, so it's not reimbursed very well. One of the big predictors of response is the platelet count. So if the patient is thrombocytopenic, if their platelet count is less than 50 especially, nobody responds to lenalidomide. So I wouldn't use it in that setting. However, if the patient's primary problem is anemia and their platelet count is preserved and they're non-DEL5Q, I would give it a go. The good thing, you know, quite quickly with lenalidomide if it's going to work or not. 5-6 weeks. By week 8, if you've given them 2 cycles, you haven't seen a response, you can stop. And that would be an appropriate use of it. The one mistake I see that's commonly made with lenalidomide in patients that are referred to me is higher risk MDS or AML, complex karyotype, excess blasts, and that complex karyotype happens to include a chromosome 5 abnormality, whether it's DEL5Q or monosomy 5. That's a different disease, and those patients don't respond to lenalidomide. Often, lenalidomide is tried, and it just doesn't work in that setting. So those are patients who would be better suited to going straight to an HMA.
So how about abstract 343, looking at AG221, enasidenib? What is it, and what do we know about it in MDS?
It's always encouraging when a drug gets a name.
Yep.
Because it's moving farther along. And that's what we see here with AG221. So I mentioned before AG120, and we talked about the molecular responses with that. That's an IDH1 isocitrate dehydrogenase 1 inhibitor. This is an isocitrate dehydrogenase 2 inhibitor, and it has a very similar response rate in AML. And so Eitan Stein, who's a wonderful young oncologist at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, presented some data from 16 patients with high-risk MDS who had IDH mutations. Now, IDH mutations are not as common in MDS as they are in AML. We're talking, 5 to 10% overall in MDS, but they are out there. And this agent did induce responses in those with the IDH2 mutation. The CR rate was low, but the overall response rate was 53%, 8 out of 15 evaluable patients. Some of them, including one of my own patients, were then able to go on and have successful allogeneic transplant. And that, I think, may be the role for IDH inhibition in MDS. If the patient has a transplant option, you could use a hypomethylating agent to bridge them to transplant. If they have an IDH mutation, maybe you use this agent instead and a hypomethylating agent only if it doesn't work. Potentially in the future, if we get more data on the combination, we could use them together.
So we were talking about checkpoint inhibitors. Now I see there's a paper, again, Dr. Garcia Manero and checkpoint inhibitors with azacitidine in untreated MDS, but here they used a combination of nivolumab and ipilimumab, I guess a standard part of melanoma therapy, but interesting looking at an MDS.
Yeah, so this was an MD Anderson study, and they were looking at patients with higher risk MDS for whom hypomethylating agents had failed. And that's a very high risk group. We know from several studies that their median survival is less than 6 months. So it's a group for which there is no established therapy, there's no FDA-approved therapy, there's nothing we know that can prolong life in that setting, so it's a huge unmet need. It's one of the two biggest unmet needs in MDS, the other being lower-risk patients for whom EPO or lenalidomide fail. So what the MD Anderson group did was design a study in which patients could get either nivolumab or ipilimumab or both. And they had different cohorts for each of these. And they continued the azacitidine, or I should say they added back the azacitidine in some patients who weren't responding. And they found that the overall response rate to Nivo alone was 0. But when you added back the azacitidine, it was 69%. 6 out of 11 patients had a response, including 2 CRs. The response rate to the ipilimumab alone arm was 22%, and there were too few patients who got the AZA added back in that arm to say much. They saw a few of the types of immune adverse events that have been noted in solid tumors. So there was a couple cases of thyroiditis, and there was a case of colitis, and there was a case of adrenal insufficiency. And these are not things that we normally see with hypomethylating agents. So they were clearly related to the checkpoint inhibitors. So their conclusion was that hypomethylating agent plus nivolumab was a reasonable thing to study in patients either for whom AZA had failed or previously untreated patients. And so, we definitely need more data here, but at least there are some responders to this combination.
Yeah, and I didn't realize, I thought it was the combination, but it's actually the combination of the checkpoint inhibitor with azacitidine. When you kind of look at this from, a macro point of view, what's your level of excitement?
My level of excitement is modest. I'm more encouraged by the use of things like venetoclax plus a hypomethylating agent or vadastuximab or targeted agent plus hypomethylating agent. I think it is going to be an uphill battle to replicate the type of success that's been seen in the melanoma and lung cancer world with these agents. The one caveat, though, is that we know from melanoma that patients don't have to have a complete response to have improved survival. And we're nowhere near being able to have any hint that that's the case in myeloid disorders. But just because the overall response rate and the CR rate aren't stellar doesn't mean that we should abandon this approach. I think we still need to do the randomized trials and see, does adding these agents to hypomethylating agent improve survival?
You know, of course, this comes up all the time. And, you know, you kind of wonder whether there might be some other parameter that you could look at other than response, particularly the issue of, let's say, progression-free survival for more than, you know, whether it's 18 months or 3 years, you know, some time period that you just normally would not see.
Yes. One way of doing that would be to follow a point mutation or a group of point mutations that are present in the MDS cells. One of the great things about doing molecular testing in MDS is that you can do it from blood, even if there's no blasts. Most of the cells circulating in MDS are part of the clone. So you could potentially serially monitor patients who are getting, say, hypomethylating agent and note whether there's any sort of clonal response or not, and that might give you an early indication of whether the patient seems to be likely to respond. And so we saw a study at the ASH annual meeting by a group in Canada and in Taiwan, and they did exactly that. They treated patients with azacitidine, and they followed the mutation burden during treatment. And they found that there was a correlation between clinical response and reduction of mutation burden. And so, you know, I think one of the things that we then have to take a step back and ask is this really useful yet clinically? Because there were some patients who did respond or had hematologic improvement at least who didn't have a reduction in mutation burden. So we're not necessarily going to stop therapy in patients whose mutation burden isn't changing. And so, you know, what then does this really add clinically? And I would say right now it's an interesting research tool, but it's not something we're doing in practice. Even though we have easy access to a molecular panel, I'm not checking after cycle 2 or cycle 4 and saying, hey, did that ASXL1 mutation go away? Because it isn't that helpful at this point.
What was the platform used in this particular study, and what are some of the platforms in general that are being looked at?
So they used a myeloid gene panel that had 84 myeloid-associated genes. And it was an Illumina HiSeq platform. That's one of the most common that's being used out there. Our particular molecular genetic testing at our institute uses a Illumina MiSeq with a custom amplicon package. And, you know, the technology seems to be pretty similar across platforms. These are all next-gen sequencing-based approaches for detecting mutations and quantifying the variant allele frequency.
So let's finish out talking a little bit about myelofibrosis and MPN, beginning with abstract 478, looking at ACE-011, sotatercept.
Yeah. So there are two drugs that modulate signaling through activin receptor 2. So sotatercept inhibits activin receptor 2A. Luspatercept inhibits activin receptor 2B. There are a number of molecules like transforming growth factor beta and GDF11 that signal through these molecules and that may inhibit red cell production, may inhibit erythropoiesis. And so in MDS, we've seen trials with both sotatercept and luspatercept. The sponsor decided to move forward with luspatercept because there was a very good response rate, actually with both of them, but luspatercept for commercial reasons, they decided to move forward. And there's an ongoing randomized placebo-controlled trial in MDS with luspatercept that hopefully will lead to registration of that drug in MDS with ring sideroblasts.
And these are fusion proteins?
They are. They are ligand traps. So basically, they're fusion proteins that bind to all of the things that normally would bind to the activin receptor 2A or 2B.
So, you know, I guess we've heard about aflibercept, the anti-angiogenic agent in colorectal. It has the same ending, But the same kind of soaking up the ligand thing, huh?
Correct. It's similar to etanercept, which binds to tumor necrosis factor alpha and which is approved for rheumatoid arthritis. Does virtually an identical thing. It's just a different family of inflammatory cytokines and red cell inhibitory cytokines. So this was a study in myelofibrosis patients who had anemia using sotatercept. And we don't do great with anemia in myelofibrosis. You know, we have ruxolitinib, which works well for shrinking the spleen and improves some of the constitutional symptoms. But when it comes to anemia, we use things like androgens or thalidomide and prednisone, and they help some patients, but we definitely need more drugs that are going to improve the red cell production in patients with MF. And so this was a study of 18 patients, and they received the sotatercept with injections every few weeks. And a few of them did have responses. It was 5 of the 14 evaluable patients, 36%, had an improvement in their hemoglobin level. One great thing about sotatercept and about luspatercept, incredibly well tolerated. You know, very, very few adverse events from these drugs that we've seen in studies thus far. And in fact, sotatercept is being moved forward in osteoporosis and in benign hematology conditions to try to improve bone density and anemia, respectively.
So what about abstract 1127, looking at ruxolitinib with 5-azacitidine in patients with myelofibrosis?
Yeah, so ruxolitinib improves the spleen size in many patients. It improves the constitutional symptoms, but it does not do much for the malignant clone. There are some patients in whom we see a reduction in JAK2 variant allele frequency, but not a lot. And so there are a couple of different approaches that are being taken to try to improve that. One is to use interferon instead. And we saw two important trials presented at the meeting with forms of alpha interferon, comparing them with actually hydroxyurea rather than ruxolitinib. The second approach that's being taken is to combine ruxolitinib with other agents like azacitidine, like hedgehog inhibitors. There are a couple other classes of drugs that are being tried, histone deacetylase inhibitors, for example, to try to reduce the clonal burden and slow disease progression. And this was a trial of that combination. So they enrolled 41 patients, and objective responses were noted in 69% of patients. And it was a mix. There were some patients that had ruxolitinib-type responses where the spleen got better or their symptoms improved. But there were a few patients who had a reduction in immature cells or in fibrosis. And JAK2 mutant allele burden in 15 patients that were tested, 87% of them had a reduction in mutant allele burden. And that's more likely to be an effect of the azacitidine than of the ruxolitinib. Now, what that is going to correlate to long term, will it extend survival? Will it delay leukemia progression? We don't know. But at the moment, it does appear that this combination can be effective not only at the usual ruxolitinib type things, but also in reducing the size of the malignant clone.
You know, it was so exciting when the COMFORT trials came out, you know, ruxolitinib, we start hear about it and the incredible, you know, clinical stories that we heard. I don't know, from a macro point of view outside here, it kind of seems like, considering that was such a revolutionary change, I don't know, it doesn't seem like that much has happened since then.
Well, one of the things that's been hard is to come up with other JAK2 inhibitors. There have been several that have died on the vine, so to speak. Fedratinib, after its pivotal study, met its endpoint. We thought it was going to be FDA approved. There were cases of Wernicke encephalopathy, so that was the end of fedratinib, at least for the moment. Pacritinib was moving forward, and then in the PERSIST-1 trial, there were an excess of deaths that needed to be adjudicated, and that has actually finally gone through the process. January 2017, the FDA lifted the clinical hold on pacritinib. momelotinib, another JAK2 inhibitor, didn't meet its endpoint in the pivotal study. And so there have been some other JAK2 inhibitors, but for the moment at least, ruxolitinib is still the king of the hill. And there are many patients who benefit from ruxolitinib. It just doesn't clearly extend survival.
What are some of the other arenas or avenues that are being looked at, both as you were talking about in terms of trying to reverse the underlying disease process and extend survival?
So there's a trial going on right now with a drug called PRM-151, which is a pentraxin analog that modifies fibrosis. There are trials going on with hedgehog inhibitors. People are trying immunotherapy, checkpoint inhibitors, and myelofibrosis. It seems it's being used in all across oncology. In fact, last year our fellows did their end of year spoof skit, and one of them was to present all these hypothetical trials adding checkpoint inhibitors to everything under the sun. It was quite well done. They're a very creative bunch, the fellows, and this was good. So
I've been portrayed in a few of those.
Yeah, exactly. So I should say, you know, I said with ruxolitinib, not a clear survival advantage. There does seem to be a modest benefit in survival in the higher risk myelofibrosis patients. It's probably related to the cytokine reduction. And so that has led ruxolitinib to be used in patients with solid tumors. There's a randomized trial in advanced pancreas cancer, gemcitabine versus gemcitabine plus ruxolitinib, where the combination patients live longer. And they live longer because what happens to patients with advanced pancreas cancer? They get bad cachexia, you know, they get muscle wasting, and those are the kinds of things that may contribute to their death. Perhaps that's how the JAK inhibitor helped, because there was no difference in response rate radiographically.